Welcome to the Back 9 Report, presented by eDraft.com.
Hello and welcome to a very special edition of the Back 9 Report presented by eDraft.com. We come online every Tuesday at 8 p.m. Eastern Time and check in on the world of golf to bring you the latest news, insights, analysis, interviews. Hey, we cover anything and everything golf. My name is Carlos Torres. Every week we bring you everything, like I said, but this week is a very special week. We're going to be counting down the 2014 top stories in golf, and for that we are very happy to bring back our colleague from eDraft and European guru and very good friend Kieran Clark. So before I bring in Fred, I'm going to bring in Kieran. Kieran, welcome back. How are you today?
Well, thank you, Carlos, and I'm feeling very good, and I'm glad to be back on the show. It's been 3 months since I was last on it, and it's been far too long, and we have a fantastic show ahead. It's been a really momentous year for golf. So many great stories, so many controversial stories, and a real kind of transitional year in many ways for the game of golf. So a lot of really interesting stuff to look back on in the next 90 minutes. I'm looking forward to it. I'm sure Fred is too.
Yes, Fred. Hi. How are you today?
I am fantastic, guys. I am so excited, just like a kid on Christmas Eve, to have Kieran back on the show tonight to help count down the top 15 biggest stories in golf this year. I just can't wait to hear what the number one story of the year is. Let's go!
Hey, we have to say something. I have to make a motion here because on Twitter today we got a motion for voting Kieran Clark making par on the road hole there as the top story. So if you want,
it was number 16, right?
Yeah, it was number 16, but now it's
just missed the lip.
But no, let's start right away with number 15, and I got that one, and that was the debut of the International Crown and the win by Spain. You know, this year we saw the inaugural edition that saw 8 national teams consisting of each one of them 4 female golfers compete for the new crown, which made its debut at Caves Valley Golf Club in Owing Mills in Maryland. It was from July 24 to the 27th. The 8 teams were Australia, Chinese Taipei, Japan, South Korea, Spain, Sweden, Thailand, and the U.S. You know, those powerhouses, the U.S. and South Korea represented there, was expected that everybody expected it to be duking it out on Sunday for all the marbles. That showdown came true, but it happened on Saturday where the U.S. was down by South Korea and missed making to the final 5 by one stroke. You know, the emotion and the thrill of representing one's country was apparent all week, but it was pure elation on the faces of the Spanish team when they earned the title of best golfing nation in the world. The squad consisting of Asahara Muñoz, Beatriz Ercari, Carlota Siganda, and Belen Mosso donned their own silver crowns by finishing the week with 15 total points. The U.S. had swept them on the first round, but there they were, elated, with a bond that goes far beyond their designation teammates, and as a whole, they are far more than merely a quartet of players thrown together to represent their country. They have been friends on and off the golf course for years, which goes a long way to explaining why they play so well against many of the finest women golfers in the world as the fifth seed. They won with 15 points. Sweden finished second with 11. South Korea with 10. Japan with 10 as well. Thailand with 9. U.S. with 6. Taiwan with 4. And Australia with 3. And the LPGA commissioner, Michael Wan, he loved the drama it created and called it a success. He foresees no changes for the next edition in 2016, other than maybe moving the qualifying for later into the year. That process precluded players like Michelle Wee from making the team with strong runs in the final 3 months leading to the event. Fred, on a positive note that reflects maybe on that success they even had, UL, the Underwriters Laboratories, was announced as the title sponsor for 2016 at Rich Harvest Farms and 2018 in South Korea.
Yeah, guys, the International Crown was a win-win for everybody. The thing was, everyone, including us, was expecting South Korea and the U.S. to dominate the International Crown in July, but the ladies from Spain said, not so fast. We will have the most fun, and we will take home the hardware, too. South Korea and the U.S. team had to compete all right. They had to fight just to make it into the finals. The U.S. lost, didn't even make it to the final day, Mozo, Munoz, Segunda, Ricari, they just played outstanding all week and really deserved the win. And Kieran, all around, it was just another big win for the LPGA Tour, which had a succession of wins in 2014.
Well, it certainly did, Fred. And actually, I remember being on the show talking about the International Crown before it started earlier in the year. It was myself and Carlos on the program that night, and we discussed about who could be the outside team that could perhaps surprise the U.S. and South Korea. And we did identify Spain as being that team. And when I look at players like Ricari and Munoz and Segunda, they're players with so much match play experience, Solheim Cup players, proven winners. And it wasn't a great surprise to me that they performed well. Perhaps winning it may have been a slight surprise, but I wasn't shocked by it, put it that way. And it was a fascinating event, and obviously a new event on the scene. And you know, I think it went down well and people enjoyed it. And certainly changes will happen for the next edition in 2 years' time. But you know, for me, it was a case of with opportunity for the LPGA Tour to introduce and to promote their international players to their U.S. audience. In the past, perhaps people perhaps criticised the LPGA Tour in America by saying, well, American players don't do too well. It's very much an Asian scene. But you know, for me, this is an opportunity for the LPGA Tour to promote their international players and show them the abilities that they have and the personalities that they have. And also, match play is very exciting as well. We don't see it very often. So it's a very interesting format, a unique format, and one that will perhaps be tweaked in future, but certainly an event that will grow in future, I would suspect. And that was number 15 on our top stories of 2014. And I have number 14, which is perhaps more of a golf political issue, if you like, and it relates to diversity within the game of golf. And Fred and Carlos, one of my great frustrations I have with the game of golf, and I love the game so much, but one thing that does bother me so much is that it has this often self-inflicted image problem. You know, the game is often perceived as being elitist, racist, and sexist, and at times, understandably so. And in more recent years, the Royal and Ancient Golf Club of St. Andrews had become a target of those criticisms. It had an all-male membership policy lasting over 260 years, and that was an embarrassment to the game of golf, particularly with the club's history as a governing body of golf throughout the world apart from the United States and Mexico. And yes, the RNA in its form as the governing body may now be a separate entity from the golf club, but the two are so closely linked. There's no discernible difference in the minds of most people. In fact, on the RNA, the governing body side of it, committee members of that and that have to be members of the RNA, the Royal Ancient Golf Club. Peter Dawson, who will stand down as chief executive of the RNA and secretary of the Royal and Ancient next year, urged the club's 2,400 membership to vote in favour of admitting female members ahead of the ballot on the 18th of September this year, which coincidentally occurred the same day as the Scottish independence referendum, a very big day in this part of the world. And, you know, as we all expected, 85% of members who participated in the ballot voted in favour of admitting those female members. And the Royal and Ancient will now seek to fast-track up to 15 women into the club, which would then allow them, as I said before, access to potentially become committee members of the governing body, the RNA, in the years to come. So symbolically, a very important step for the Royal and Ancient Golf Club, and, you know, and with it, a positive development for the game of golf as well, particularly with the Olympic Games coming up in less than 2 years' time. You know, I mentioned that that's more of a sexist issue. I mentioned the racial aspect as well that golf had down the years. And you know, there's a positive recognition this year for a very important figure back in November there, regarding golf and race. And that was 92-year-old Charlie Sifford, who broke discriminatory barriers to compete on the PGA Tour back in the 1960s, and he received the Presidential Medal of Freedom from President Barack Obama, and that is, of course, the highest civilian honor in the United States. And Sifford, who was originally from Charlotte, North Carolina, was a very gifted player, someone whose talent should have seen him become a major contender within the professional game. But he wasn't able to initially. Why? Because he was black. The PGA of America, and with it the PGA Tour, had a Caucasian-only policy, which seems absolutely astonishing to this day. It's a remarkable thing that they had back then. And Sifford fought against this, and he sought out Stanley Mosk, who was the California Attorney General. Sifford lived in California at this point, and the Attorney General helped open the door for Sifford. Sifford was barred from competing in PGA tournaments within California, so Mosk presented Sifford as a Californian resident whose civil rights were being violated. And in 1960, the PGA relented and granted Sifford access to the PGA Tour. He was the first black player to have that designation. So he was a tour rookie at the age of 38, and he would later claim two titles in the PGA Tour in Hartford and in Los Angeles. And in November 1961, the Caucasian clause was removed, and Sifford became a full member of the PGA of America at the age of 42. But he still had to face discrimination. He was barred from dining in many clubhouses around the country. He faced threats, insults, and intimidation from people across the country as he was competing on the PGA Tour. And all of this makes his story all the more remarkable. And he helped pave the way for African-American players in the future. And none were more vocal of their appreciation, head of the award, than Tiger Woods. And Sifford was also inducted into the World Golf Hall of Fame 10 years ago. And this Presidential Medal of Freedom is a fitting accolade for a truly inspirational man. And your friend Carlos, these stories remind us of golf's shameful history when it comes to equality for all. And you know that barriers still have to be broken down.
It certainly does. And Kieran, for most of its history, the game of golf has struggled with issues of diversity. And although much has improved, there's still ways to go. And the future of women and minorities in the game can be tremendous. There are so many positive aspects on the game of golf. It's great for one's health, for spending time with the family and friends, for competing in a lifetime game, for networking, and even for college scholarships. You know, golf is mentally stimulating and physically challenging, and these are qualities that other sports don't necessarily share, and we need to introduce them to everyone. Golf is the only outdoor sport that one can play for a lifetime, regardless of strength or age or even disabilities. Its future right now is in the hands of those leaders and decision makers who must act now to ensure the game's bright future. Fred, simply put, nature and golf courses do not see color or sex, and neither should anyone replace it.
Yeah, and it's, you know, women have been making great strides in the game of golf, albeit maybe slowly. But, we've got three women members now at Augusta National. Women now were voted into the RNA this year, which is a gigantic step. The Charlie Sifford thing. You know, he played at a time when African Americans were not allowed through the country club gates, only as caddies. He was the Jackie Robinson of golf and opened the doors for players like Lee Elder, Calvin Peet, Jim Thorpe, and yes, Tiger Woods, to dream of playing on the PGA Tour and even become one of the greatest golfers of all time. Due to the efforts of guys like Charles Sifford, golf has become a place that accepts diverse cultures. Global Golf Post chose a 20-year-old black woman, Maria Stackhouse, as one of the Amateurs of the Year. And Cheyenne Woods just earned her LPGA Tour card. Arnie and Jack are the only other golfers to have received the high honor that Charles Sifford received as the Presidential Medal of Freedom. For a guy who spent most of his golfing career as an unknown, it's wonderful that he can finally be recognized for his great achievements. That wraps up number 14. Number 13 on our list involves Lexi Thompson. Lexi won the Kraft Nabisco Championship back in March. It was the first major championship of the year on the women's tour and on any tour. You know, it seems like Lexi Thompson has been in golf's headlines for nearly 10 years. Well, oh yeah, she has. She was the youngest to ever qualify for the U.S. Women's Open in 2007 at the tender age of 12. She lost that honor last year when Lucy Lee qualified at the age of 10. Lexi qualified for the U.S. Women's Open three times before she was 15 and made the cut in 2009 when she was only 14. Just to top off that year, she made the cut at the Navistar LPGA Classic and finished T27 against a field of professionals. She turned pro in 2010 at the age of 16 and once again qualified for the U.S. Women's Open, finishing T10. Later that same year, she finished runner-up at the Evian Championship. In just a handful of starts in 2010, Thompson earned over $310,000, which would have ranked her number 18 on the LPGA Tour money list and would have guaranteed her a card for 2011. Even with this success, LPGA Tour Commissioner Michael Wan denied her petition to join the LPGA Tour, and she was forced to Monday qualify. 2011 was Lexi's breakout year. She won the Navistar LPGA Classic and the Dubai Ladies Masters on the Ladies European Tour. Even though she was still only 17 years old, Michael Wan had no choice but to grant her petition for full membership in 2012. The rest is history. She won twice in 2013 and added the Kraft Nabisco Championship as her first major win this year in March. The Kraft Nabisco Championship is one of the biggest events on the LPGA Tour. It's like the Masters on the men's tour, always played on the same course, and it's the first major championship of the year. Lexi's won by bombing her driver at the Kraft Nabisco, plus the duel on Sunday with Michelle Wee in the final round was a huge boost for the LPGA. It set the stage for the entire year. Lexi Thompson gives the LPGA Tour a young, talented American woman to fill up the television cameras. With the LPGA Tour being dominated for so long by the international players, the emergence of a young superstar like Lexi brings a myriad of girls, American girls, to golf. Kieran, you can call it, or Carlos, I guess, is next here, I'm sorry. You can call it the Tiger Effect if you want. She will spawn a new age of girls taking up the game and wanting to be like Lexi.
Yeah, that's big.
Well, it's my little rebuttal here, Fred, but yes, I completely agree with you. And Lexi's win at the Kraft Nabisco was absolutely fantastic. She played tremendously well. As you say, from tee to green, she's such a dominant player, hits the ball so far, and an excellent iron player. And her duel there with Michelle Wee, you know, in many ways, Lexi is this generation's Michelle Wee, you know, a young prodigy, if you like, coming into the game as a young girl. And two immense talents there, and two, as you say, American talents. It's a big thing for the LPGA Tour, of course, from a marketing and popularity standpoint. And you know, it was a fantastic watch, and Lexi's such a tremendous talent. And to me, this is the first of many major championships for her. You know, she is such a great level of ability, and now with this win behind her, she will only build on that, I think, in the coming years. And Carl, I'm sure you agree with me here, but you know, Lexi's a great win for her, and as Fred said, it set the standard and the stage up for what was a fantastic year for the LPGA Tour.
Definitely, she was one of those bright stars and bright spots. She's a big hitting 19-year-old. She bumped and gouged her way there around Mission Hills at the crowd in ways you normally don't see women do. She was launching drivers with impunity while breaking through to win her first major championship in what was an intriguing Sunday, their duel against Michelle Wee. So that matchup was electric, and hopefully we can see more of her next year. As you know, Lexi, along with Lydia Ko, they are women's golf's brightest young stars. Well, that wraps up number 13, and now we go for number 12, and we have to talk now about another young star, and that's Jordan Spieth, who seems like a great young guy. In case you missed it, on the final weekend of November, the 21-year-old Texan won the Australian Open by a massive 6 strokes. He then flew over 9,000 miles to Orlando to play and destroy the field of the Hero World Challenge, winning by 10 strokes and breaking the record of someone called Tiger Woods, you might have heard of him, and who happens to be the host of the event, and finished just 26 shots in last place behind Spieth. In case you're counting miles, take into consideration that Spieth had played and finished T3rd at the Japan's Dunlop Phoenix the week prior to his win in the Australian Open. He now has won by a combined 16 strokes in consecutive starts, something that, with all his dominant performances, Woods has accomplished just twice in his career. Spieth was close to flawless on the final day in brutal wind as he shot a course record 63 at the Australian Golf Club, the lowest round of the day by 4 shots. Rory McIlroy, he said after, he wouldn't have been able to shoot 63 on that course in those conditions, even if he was given 100 tries. Maybe 101 he would have done it. His winning margin was the biggest since Greg Norman's triumph in 1996. But, you know, Norman's fifth and final win in that tournament was when he was on the downslope of his career. Spieth is on the upswing, and how? He has won only 3 professional tournaments, but as we all know, it's the tournament he ran second in his first attempt back in April that still has people buzzing. It was a little event, you might have heard, he's called the Masters. So much of the end of the year was about, the talk was about Billy Horschel, Chris Kirk, and of course, Rory and Ricky, and deservedly so. But as you know, at the first half of this year, Jordan Spieth was the PGA Tour's big story, He was almost a pre-tournament favorite in every event he entered, even in the majors. He became the nearly man with close calls at the Masters and at the Players, yet posted only one top 10 after that. But look now. Yes, neither were official PGA Tour events, but what Jordan Spieth did versus some elite competition on his last 2 weeks of competition this year was remarkable. His back-to-back wins now give him 3 official worldwide wins as a pro and make him the unofficial hottest golfer in the world entering next year. Spieth is now number 9 in the world and doesn't turn 22 until the next summer. A taste of things to come? Hey, Fred, just remember that last year it was the Australian Open win that sparked a run that might have captured some headlines this year. You know, won by the name of a guy named Rory McIlroy.
Yeah, we pointed at that. You know, at the time, that could be a springboard for 2014, and it certainly was for Rory, and this could very well be for Jordan also. You know, he had a very good year in 2014, and don't forget, he was runner-up at Augusta, just like you mentioned, and if that's all he did all year, it would have been better than most tour players. His year didn't measure up to the extremely high standard that he had set in 2013 when he started the year with no status. He earned exemption. He won the John Deere. He got a spot on the President's Cup team. Just phenomenal stuff. He entered the year at, what, number 8 on the money list or something after the FedEx Cup. You know, just unbelievable in 2013. But 2014 was a good, solid year. But here at the end is when he really took off. The strong finish demonstrates that when he gets out of his own way and allows things just to happen, there's not too many that can play at his level. He posted 63s on championship-caliber golf courses 2 consecutive weeks. That's pretty good stuff. Kieran, I think it's pretty safe to assume that he will contend for major titles and more wins in 2015, as well as for many years to come.
Yeah, unquestionably, Fred. And that 63 shot on Sunday at the Australian Golf Club, I would put that down as the best round I saw all year. It was fantastic, incredible, and that wind, and you know, it was a tremendous performance. And Jordan Spieth, in many ways, is a very old-fashioned style player. If you look at his stats on the PGA Tour website, it's all very average-looking. His distance, his accuracy, his greens and regulation, it's all fairly middling. But his stroke average is extremely good. He knows how to score, and that is a wonderful asset to have in the modern game. There's so many players in the game now who can hit the ball magnificently well and hit it robotically. He's someone who can play the game of golf, and that is such an asset when it comes to major championships. And I think here as well, getting those 2 wins, yes, they're unofficial events in the PGA Tour, and it's, you know, not the strongest deals in the world, but the confidence you get from winning events, and that's something he hasn't had too much of as a professional thus far, and he certainly was getting frustrated by that. He had so many opportunities this year, particularly in the first half, and he didn't quite get the job done, with some getting very frustrated at Torrey Pines and at the Masters and at the Players' Championship. He kind of lost his composure on those occasions, but he's learned from those experiences, and he won those 2 events here in Florida and in Australia, and that will only benefit him going into next season. I think Jordan Spieth is really a star. He's a star in the making. He's a star of right now. And I think next year could be his year for a lot of success. And, you know, Fred and Carlson, we mentioned someone like Jordan Spieth, who's really a star of the future and in many ways the present. I'm going to talk about 2 players who perhaps are on the wane, 2 stars of the past, 2 of the great players who are on the downward spiral in terms of their careers, and that's Phil Mickelson and Ernie Els, who had really, really poor years. And in many ways, 2014 to me felt like a transition into a new era for the men's game. Rory McIlroy firmly established himself as the game's leading player with 2 major championships, while the likes of Jason Day, Billy Horschel, as I say, Jordan Spieth, Ricky Fowler, Patrick Reed, and Victor Dubuisson dominated golfing headlines throughout the year. And they're all players in their 20s, and there's even more of those players that I failed to mention. It's such a large group of them now. And as Tiger Woods succumbed to his worst season as a professional, 2 of his contemporaries also endured disappointing campaigns. Phil Mickelson, the 5-time major champion, struggled all year, consistently failing to put 4 decent rounds together in a tournament. A runner-up in the PGA Championship, Valhalla, was his only top 10 on the PGA Tour all season. A remarkable statistic from a 42-time PGA Tour champion. And as he approaches his 45th birthday, perhaps Mickelson's career has begun to wind down. And yes, It may only be just over a year since his tremendous victory in the Open Championship at Muirfield, but time doesn't stand still, particularly with such a maelstrom of young talent bursting onto the scene. And with his arthritis problem, there's always an undercurrent of concern for observers regarding his body and how that may simply not be allowing him to compete to the standard that he was before. And for me, you know, 2015 is a huge season for Phil Mickelson. We've seen him recently, he's lost quite a lot of weight, he's looking trimmer, and he's certainly determined to get back to the top of his game. Will he, will or not, we'll have to wait and see. But he's not alone. As I say, Ernie Els, the great South African, has actually fallen out of the world's top 50. The 45-year-old season was patchy and inconsistent. He had some good moments, he played well in the match play, and he had a top 10 at Valhalla. But to me, it's clear that his best days are now behind him. However, he was in this position 3 years ago, and he did rebound that year to win the Open Championship at Royal Livam. So, a repeat of that would seem unlikely, I would say. But he did speak the other day of his determination to win the Masters. And you know, that Open triumph, of course, does get him exempt for Augusta until 2017, so he has at least a couple of more opportunities to get that green jacket that's eluded him so far. But it would be a surprise if it happened. And these two, Mickelson and Els, are two of the greatest players of their generation. And you know, and they may yet have their good days to come in future. They may still win tournaments. They may occasionally contend in majors, as class never leaves you. Class is permanent. But I do feel we have to start looking past them now as being two of the game's elite players. There's a new breed on the scene, Carlos. And you know, in the end, such transitions have happened throughout the years. You know, it's only natural. You know, new generations come through, take over the mantle from the older guys. But those older guys can still play, and they will have to play well next year, Carlos.
I have to subscribe what you say. They're two of the game's great all time, and it's sad to see what happens. And, you know, when at the end of the year, what you were talking about Phil Mickelson is him taking charge at the first task force meeting, you know something's wrong with his game, definitely. I mean, all you know is that he started the year in the top 10 in the world, and right now he is all the way down to number 10. He was number 4. He's 44 years old, like you mentioned. Ernie Els is 45. He started the year at the 21st rank, and now he's number 61. So definitely so sad to see this, but like you say, we have to start looking at them past their prime. And like you say, I look for them to contend, but definitely, like you mentioned, they're declining fortunes for him, Fred.
Yeah, it always amazes me how much down the same track that we all are usually, and I'm right with you guys with everything you've said. I know we're going to talk about Tiger later. You could add him into this conversation maybe, but with the advent of the younger players on the tour and the decline of some of the veterans, there is truly a changing of the guard at the top of the world golf rankings. Phil just had a terrible year, you know, one top 10 at the PGA Championship. You know, is it age, arthritis, or apathy that's bringing an end to one of the most brilliant golf careers of any golfer? If not for Tiger, Phil would have been the dominant player of the last 10 to 15 years. We will still see Phil and Ernie pop up to challenge and possibly win on tour and maybe even a major or two, but the game is for the young guys. The travel, you know, the constant playing, the walking up and down the hills. It's, you know, 45-year-olds just need not apply. It's just not for them. So, you know, these guys have had their day. Anything we see from them is a bonus, but just don't expect it too often from here on out. Guys, that wraps up the top five on our top 15 list, the bottom five, I should say. So getting to number 10, Ricky Fowler had top fives in all five majors. Ricky Fowler lost his coach in 2013 and ended up a student of Butch Harmon near the end of the year. Butch tightened up his swing somewhat, but more than anything, he instilled in Fowler the belief that he deserves to be among the best players in the world, and he can beat the Bubbas, the Dustins, and the Tigers of the world. Fowler is still only 26 years old. He finished T5 of the Masters, runner-up at both the U.S. Open and the Open Championships, and ended the year with a T4 at the PGA Championship. Most PGA professionals dream of one top five or top ten in a major for their career. Fowler had four in 1 year. He became the only player to ever finish inside the top five in all four majors without collecting a win. That may be a dubious honor, but don't forget he also finished third at the WGC Accenture Match Play in February. Pretty good year. In 26 starts last season, he had 19 top 25s, 10 top 10s, earned $4.8 million, and was number 9 in the FedEx Cup. He didn't have a win, but probably only Rory, with his two majors and the WGC win, had a better year than Ricky Fowler. Fowler now has the confidence in his new swing and his ability on the golf course. He was one of the most decorated amateur players ever when he competed against these same guys in college. He seems to have also gained a calmness and confidence that allows him to take what the golf course gives him and not take unnecessary risks. That's the kind of mentality that will win tour events and major titles. More and more, we're seeing young guys dominate on the PGA Tour. Ricky Fowler is one of the...
As you say, no wins for Ricky Fowler, and that's the one sort of caveat of the year. But he played so well, so consistently well throughout it. And you mentioned there the Butch Haran effect. You know, Butch came in at the end of last year, tightened up his swing. But I think as well, Butch is a fantastic sports psychologist. He helps the mentality of his players really well. I think having someone with the stature and experience of Butch Haran alongside them, I think that gives the player an inner strength and belief and confidence. We saw it with Jimmy Walker as well, of course, with 3 wins after joining Butch Haran as coach. So, but for Ricky, you know, he played so well in the majors. But the no wins must be a great frustration for him. And, you know, in the end, he's been around for 5 or 6 years now on the PGA Tour, and he has one win to show for it at the Quail Hollow Championship a few years ago. So that's a very poor return given the talent that he has. And he has a fantastic level of talent. You know, I've watched him play in the Open Championship a number of times in bad conditions. He has such a great variety of shots. He's a fantastic talent, a great player. But he has to turn it into wins. Otherwise, it'll become a habit. And I think it's very important for him next season to get a win in the first 2 or 3 months of the year, to get that confidence going, get a winning belief going into the Masters, into the major season. But certainly talent-wise, he's a tremendous player, and I think he's going to be, you know, as I say, there's no wins. He did say after the PGA Championship in August that that one hurt. So the lack of wins did hurt him, but certainly the level of his play will give him such a great deal of confidence, Carlos, going into next season.
It certainly does. Fred, I don't know if you still had something to say at the end there. You want to
Just that, you know, he's definitely one of the best young guys, and, you know, he's going to, along with Spieth, challenge Rory for titles next year. That was the only thing.
You know, after having gone so long without a coach, his hands were getting too close to his body, and his arm plane was too flat on the takeaway, which led to the club getting stuck or trapped behind him. So unless his time was perfect, he was susceptible to hooks. He also had lower back pain. He twice visited Butch Haran in Las Vegas, but mostly they swapped videos over their smartphones. He moved his hands higher at the top, his arms farther out in front of him because of his advice, and the rest is history, what has happened with him. He did all those major wins. You know, Rory McIlroy had the best year in 2014, but Fowler wasn't far behind his fellow 25-year-old friend. He netted top fives in all majors, ascended to the top 10 in the world, and was easily the tour's most improved player. You know, that new partnership with Haran has paid big dividends. The path followed to him with Haran is one that looks very bright, very promising, and hopefully we can see him and Jordan Spieth challenge Rory McIlroy. Hopefully 2015 will be very powerful. That wraps up number 10 with Ricky Fowler, and now I have number 9, which is about domination. World Golf Hall of Fame member Bernard Langer, he's from Germany and now resides in Boca Raton, Florida. He received the Jack Nicklaus Award as the Player of the Year after recording 5 victories this year, including 2 major championships. He's the first player to win the award 4 times. Langer also captured the season-long Charles Schwab Cup for the second time in his career. The Schwab Cup is a points-based competition which recognizes the Champions Tour's most consistent player. He became the second player in history following Hale Irwin in 2002 to clinch the Schwab Cup before the final event of the season, earning an insurmountable lead after the AT&T Championship the week preceding the season finale. He led the standings all but 1 week and now joins Irwin, Tom Watson, Jay Hasler, Roberts, and Tom Lehman as multiple winners of the Schwab Cup. Langer also won the Arnold Palmer Award as the Champions Tour leading money winner for a record sixth time. He surpassed $3 million during the season for the first time in his Champions Tour career and set the all-time record, beating the previous record held by Hale Irwin that was established in 2002. Langer also claimed the Byron Nelson Award as the Champions Tour scoring leader. You know, his 68.03 scoring average for the year was the second best all-time in Champions Tour history, better only by Freddie Couples' 67.96 average in 2010. It's the third time Langer wins this award. But the exclamation point came earlier in the season. You know, you might all remember Rory McIlroy's multi-shot win that felt like a cruise to the Open Championship. What should we call then Bernhard Langer's dominance 1 week later at the Senior Open Championship? This was Tiger Woods at Pebble Beach in 2000 dominant, where a player overwhelms a field and course and is simply playing a different tournament than everyone else. Seems like he would have challenged and beaten anyone, whether he was playing the Champions Tour or not, that week at Royal Portcull. Colin Montgomery, who had just won the U.S. Senior Open and the Senior PGA, made another impressive run to finish 5-under, but that was a record 13 shots worse than Langer. He also posted a championship record scored in relation to par 18 under with his win and earned a spot in next year's Open Championship at St. Andrews. Fred, you know, last time I checked, there was a picture of Langer under the definition of domination in the dictionary.
Yeah, you know, we said earlier in the year, Carlos, that this year, this performance by Bernhard Langer is, I mean, it was like Tiger-esque. It really, really was something. He just had one of the best years in golf that anyone has ever achieved. He was even in the conversation as a possible captain's pick for the European Ryder Cup. And we all know how good they were. You know, 18 top tens and 21 starts, 12 top threes with 5 wins. Just unbelievable. 2 major wins, the senior players and the senior open, and that second one, the senior open, and Gale wins in Wales there where you couldn't even hardly stand up. You know, he won the Charles Schwab Cup even before the Tour Championship teed up. So, and carrying the icing on the cake, he teams up with his 14-year-old son last weekend to win the PNC Father-Son Challenge after his daughter had to WD with an injury. That's, you know, pretty good stuff and kind of a nice end to the year for him.
Yeah, absolutely, Fred. It's been quite a year for Bernhard Langer. And as you both rightly said there about the Senior Open Championship at Royal Portcull, for me that was the highlight of his season. And you know, watching that on a completely baked golf course, the golf course was brown, it was playing on concrete. It was an immense challenge to compete in that golf course. It was like an Open Championship from the 1970s. It was really old school. There was a good breeze as well. And he just, it was an astonishing performance. To go out there and win by 13 shots, and he was so controlled, his game was just immaculate. You know, yes, it's senior golf, and people will perhaps roll their eyes at this, but for me, that was one of the best 72-hole performances I've ever seen. That is up there in the top 10. It was just a remarkable display of golf, so controlled, and you know, he's such a meticulous player. And you know, in many ways, perhaps quite an underrated player down the years, even when he's regular tour career. You know, this is a guy who has 2 Masters titles, 40 European tour wins in his career. He is one of the all-time greats. And he's proven that as a senior tour player now. And but an unbelievable year for Bernhard Langer. And at 57, you know, he's not one of the younger guys in the senior tour anymore. So can he go into next year and continue to dominate? I would say he certainly can. And that was one great German victory there, and a great year for Bernhard Langer and number 9. And number 8 on our list of top 10 of top 15 stories in 2014 is another German, arguably Langer's successor and the crown as Germany's greatest golfer, and that is Martin Keimer, who, of course, had a great rebounding year this season after a couple of years of struggles. And the US Open, of course, he won wire to wire in a brilliant performance. And yet another, much like Langer at Porthcawl, another Brown golf course at Pinehurst number two. And for me, guys, this year's US Open was always going to be the most intriguing event of the season. For me, I was very interested to see the restored Pinehurst number two with Bill Coore and Ben Crenshaw taking the iconic course back to the principles of its original designer, Donald Ross. Rugged, brown and firm, Pinehurst was unlike anything we had seen in America's national championship for at least half a century. You know, I liked it a lot, even if the USGA did let things get a little bit out of hand in terms of the green firmness in the weekend. However, to succeed on such a golf course would require a player on top of both his game technically and mentally. And having just come off victory at the Players' Championship at Sawgrass, Martin Kaymer was that man. And opening with two straight rounds of 65, the likeable German was six shots clear at the halfway stage. I say about the greens getting firmer over the weekend. Scoring became more difficult on Saturday. And the 2010 PGA champion shot a 72, but he still sat five shots ahead of Eric Compton, who's one of the great stories of the year, by the way, in that championship. Remarkable achievement for him finishing second. And Ricky Fowler was also there after three rounds. But on Sunday, Martin Kaymer produced a masterclass on how to close out a tournament on a difficult golf course, intelligently plotting his way around Pinehurst's uncooperative fairways. And Kaymer didn't make many mistakes, but when he did, his short game and putting minimized the damage, and that is such a crucial aspect in a US Open. It was just a brilliant performance. Can we say Langer-esque, if you like? Or perhaps Langer was Kaymer-esque at Porthcawl. They were both tremendous. And this win, along with his Players' Championship triumph, represented a fantastic return to form for Kaymer, who has struggled for a couple of years while attempting swing changes. And while he drifted away from the top of the game, it was easy to forget just how good a player he was and is. And for me, Martin Kaymer is among golf's most underrated players. You know, yet to turn 30, he turns 30 at the end of this month. He has won two major championships, a Players' Championship, played in three Ryder Cups, and spent a period as the world's number one ranked player. You know, he is just a tremendous talent, and that's a pretty strong resume. And for me, Carlos, there's more to come from him as he enters his 30s.
Oh, there definitely is. You know, he's that U.S. Open trophy Martin Kaymer won that Sunday was all he needed to prove he was anything but a one-hit wonder in the majors, and that the 2 years he spent trying to build a complete game, swing rebuildings were worth all the doubt that followed him. As he set it down there on the table, he rubbed off a tiny smudge on the gleaming silver, which was only fitting. Over 4 days at Pinehurst 2, he dusted the field in a performance that ranks among the best ever. You know, he set the 36-hole scoring record by opening with a pair of 65s. He never let anyone closer than four shots over the final 48 holes. You know, equipped with that 48-hole... equipped with a five-shot lead, I'm sorry, he was the only player from the last eight groups to break par. Kaymer is looking forward now to going back to his home for the holidays, and for a good reason. He'll be home in Germany for Christmas for the first time since 2006. He also has a house in Arizona. And all I have left to say, Fred, is welcome back home, Martin, you know, to Germany and majors contention.
Yeah, you know, Pinehurst was nearly unplayable. It was so hard and firm. Those bowl-shaped greens would not hold a shot, and Kaymer put on a short game clinic. When he is on like he was that week, his swing is as good as anybody that's ever played the game. I simply call it majestic. I loved his swing 2-3 years ago when he was playing so well, and it was back to that level this year at the U.S. Open. It's just a pure joy to watch. He was confident all week, and when most of the guys were afraid to hit it to the green, he played to the safe side, took his ups and downs in stride, and just went about his business. He was the best player that week by far. Really, really good display of golf. That wraps up number eight. Moving on to number seven in our countdown. We're almost halfway through here. Christina Kim comeback win in Mexico. The LPGA Tour had a remarkable storylines all season long. Michelle Wee, Lydia Ko, Lexi Thompson all winning. Stacey Lewis and NB Park battling for number one. But maybe the best story was the return of Christina Kim to the winner's circle at the Lorena Ochoa Invitational in mid-November. Christina Kim turned professional in 2002 after a successful amateur career. Her first professional win came at the 2002 Garden State Future Summer Classic in a playoff over another budding young professional, Lorena Ochoa. Both Ochoa and Kim earned full LPGA Tour status for 2003 and have been close friends ever since. The Lorena Ochoa Invitational was Kim's third LPGA Tour win, but her first since 2005. Even though she's flamboyant in her dress and her personality, she has struggled with severe depression and was close to committing suicide. Her return to competitive golf and succeed against the best woman golfers in the world is a story worthy of major headlines. The life of a professional golfer is not an easy one. To the casual golf fan, the television coverage, the international travel, and big checks seem like a dream occupation. The reality is constant travel, lost luggage, bad food, loneliness, and fatigue. Only the top players are making serious money, and the rest are constantly searching for the magic formula to reach the top of the leaderboard and find deep-pocket sponsors to pay the tab. The constant struggle can mentally defeat even the strongest person. Christina Kim has been to the edge of the cliff and come back more determined and ready to succeed. She was one of only a few players to play in all six of the Asian swing tournaments leading up to the Lorena Ochoa. And the $200,000 first place check she earned at the Lorena Ochoa Invitational assured her a spot on the LPGA for 2015. Kieran, one of the biggest stories, not only in women's golf but in all of golf, was the return of Christina Kim to the winner's circle at the Lorena Ochoa Invitational.
Absolutely, Fred, and well put there of your statement. And for me, it was really the greatest human story in golf this year. It was see her back in the winner's circle, something that may not have happened, or perhaps at one point never seemed even likely to happen. And she went through such a dark period in her life, and I've had similar issues in my time, and I can kind of empathize with how she felt and know how difficult it is. So to come back from that is truly inspirational for so many people. And she has a really gregarious personality, as you said, Fred, and that can often mask so much behind inside your head, and no one can see that. And that's often the most dangerous thing you can have wrong with you, is what's going on in between your ears. But you know, to see her back on the LPGA Tour now full time is fantastic, back in the winner's circle, and really her goal now should be trying to get back on the Silhan Cup team for next year in Germany. And she obviously played a big part in the Silhan Cups in the past, really got involved in the team atmosphere. And on that subject, you can see how, I always say, when a player wins, you can see how popular they are as individuals by the response they get on social media. How many players tweet congratulations to them. And I've never seen any player receive as many congratulations as Christina Kim received a few weeks ago after winning Lorena Ochoa. A very popular player, and it is absolutely fantastic to see her back on form, Carlos, and back where she belongs, on the LPGA Tour, and a winner again.
You know, Kim kicked off what she termed her second act with an inspirational, joyous, and impassionate playoff win that Sunday at the Lorena Shore that ended a 9-year LPGA Tour winless streak. That selfie that she snapped after leaping, dancing, and celebrating with her caddy, boyfriend, and Michelle Wee on the 18th green captured the emotions of the moment that was nearly a decade in the making. A tearful Wee was one of the many fans to tweet congratulations to the 3-time Tour winner, who has battled back from the brink of suicide to the top of the leaderboard. Her triumph is particularly poignant considering the depression that consumed a golfer like her, known for her exuberance, and led her to consider suicide. Struggles she chronicled in a blog post 2 years ago. She has credited her mother and others close to her very survival. And, you know, I said earlier about Langer being the definition of domination. Kim, who is one of the most liked players in the LPGA, to me now, she's the definition of inspiration. Well, that wraps up
number 7, and now we have to go to number 6, and we keep it in the LPGA, and number 6 is Michelle Wee's resurgence year. She won her first major and contended on the CME. You know, with her victory near her Hawaiian home at the Lodi Championship in April and her major championship breakthrough winning the U.S. Women's Open in June, we showed this year that she's prepared to be a consistent force in the women's game. She left the season-ending CME Tour Group Tour Championship hungry to build on all she achieved this year. She left making it clear she isn't done making news. We departed Pinehurst number 2 in June with the U.S. Women's Open trophy in her hands and eyeing the potential for a monster season that seemed destined since she caught the attention of the golf world 13 years ago as a 12-year-old. A month later, she injured the index finger in her right hand, which eventually forced her to miss 4 tournaments as she couldn't hold a toothbrush or a fork, let alone a 9-iron. Upon her return at the Evian Championship in September, the final major of the season, she withdrew after 13 holes when the injury flared up. We were left only to guess what could have been if she played healthy all year. Her resurgence was good for the entire women's game. Even her rivals saw that. The NBC's U.S. Women's Open TV ratings boosted to 1.7 in the final round, a 92% increase over the 2013's final round. We may not be the best player in the women's game yet, but she definitely is the biggest star. Her rivals see that too. So does Hall of Famer Pat Bradley, who watched Wee and win and thought about how she and so many other players of that generation benefited playing with the popular Nancy Lopez in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. Wee won the inaugural Rolex Annika Major Award for the best overall performance in the women's majors this year. Though her Sunday duel with Lexi Thompson came up short at the Kraft Navisco, it was another early sign that Wee is putting together all the pieces in her game. Her star cross career has been littered with injuries to her wrist and knees. She's still not 100%, but she's all the way up to number 6 in the Rolex World rankings. And remember that she was number 103 just a little more than a year before winning at Pinehurst. David Ledbetter, her swing coach, believes that she hasn't reached her summit in this hard climb back. With her health returning, with her skills and confidence coming back, Fred, Ledbetter believes Wee has started a second act to her career that could be something special, and I cannot wait for the curtains to be risen.
Yeah, we documented it all year, and Michael Wan and the LPGA Tour were the beneficiary of some very good play from some very popular players this year. As we've said, it was undoubtedly one of the best years ever on the LPGA Tour. And one of the big aspects of that was the resurgence of Michelle Wee, you know, finally reaching her potential and becoming a dominant force on tour. You know, it finally happened this year. Her runner-up finish to Lexi at the first major of the year, the Kraft Navisco in March, you know, was electrifying. She won in Hawaii at the Lotte LPGA Championship in April and collected her first major of the year then in June at the U.S. Women's Open at Pinehurst, all the while exhibiting the best swing in golf. If you're looking to copy a golf swing or just to see what a perfect golf swing should look like, you only need to look at tape of Michelle Wee prior to her injury this season. Speaking of her injury that you mentioned, Carlos, the way she was playing prior to that, she would have challenged Park and Lewis and Co. for one of the top 3 spots on the Rolex ranking. She missed several tournaments in the second half of the season and just was not the same player when she tried to come back. Kieran, she more than any single player will draw more eyes to the LPGA Tour. She has that Tiger effect and can bring more sponsorship and endorsement money to the women's game.
Oh, you know, Fred, of that there is no doubt. And I go back to even 10 years ago when she was a teenager coming onto the scene and as an amateur and playing so well in the major championships and so on. Even though you had Annika Sorenstam there in the LPGA Tour, who's arguably the game's greatest female ever player, Michelle Wee was a bigger star than even Annika was, and that's still the case. You know, Stacey Lewis, Lydia Ko, they're all tremendous players, unbelievable talents, but still Michelle Wee has remained that number one star player in the minds of of the average golf fan, the sports fan, and they certainly tuned in to watch her win the U.S. Open back in June. And, you know, it was a real breakthrough moment for her. You know, such a great level of talent, so much expectation, and with all those eyes on you, you know, in that spotlight, it couldn't have been easy for her to handle as a young woman, as a teenager. But she seems far more mature now. She's, you know, came through college. And I think, you know, people maybe question if she's doing the right thing or not doing all that, but I think she did the right thing in the end. She's now a stronger person and undoubtedly a better player for it. And unfortunately, the injury problems are certainly what could have been for this year, and hopefully they'll impact her in the longer term, because Michelle Wee, when on form, is just an extraordinary player to watch. As Fred says, majestic golf swing, so powerful, effortlessly powerful as well. Just a wonderful player to watch, and certainly one of the real bright stars in what has been a fantastic year for the LPGA Tour. We keep saying it, but it's so true. And that was number six, gentlemen, on our top 15. And on to number five. We said there that Michelle Wee is by far the best-known, biggest star on the LPGA Tour. And no matter what happens, the biggest star in the men's game will always be Tiger Woods. And I think I've sort of drawn the short straw here by having to go through Tiger section here, because it's quite a story this year. But, you know, as has seemingly been the case for more than 5 years now, even in 2008, it was yet another tumultuous season for the 14-time major champion Tiger Woods. Success that came so easily to him for more than a decade now appears to be becoming progressively more difficult to achieve as time marches on. But of course, in 2013, Woods had won five times, and he reclaimed the world number one spot back in March of last year. And you know, he dominated that spot for 10 years, and he was back in number one. So 2014 really should have been the year in which he pushed on and returned to major winning glory as he, you know, sought to catch up with Jack Nicklaus's 18 major record. But it quite simply wasn't to be this year. After a slow start to the season in his first two events, Woods was forced to withdraw from the Honda Classic on Sunday due to back pain during the final round. He did compete in the Cadillac Championship at Doral, but visibly struggled with his back. And he would subsequently miss the Arnold Palmer Invitational, a place where he had so much success in the past, and then the Masters Tournament for the first time as a professional, after undergoing a micro-dissectomy operation on his back. But of course, you know, we thought that had taken up the game for perhaps the entire year, but he surprisingly announced his return for the Quicken Loans National in June, an event that he hosts and it benefits his foundation, so we can perhaps read into that as perhaps he was there for the sponsors more than anything else. But Tiger returned in June, well ahead of schedule, and he struggled around the Congressional there. You know, but despite many observers questioning whether he'd come back from injuries far too soon, Woods did go on to compete in the Open Championship, where he finished 69th, and also at the PGA Championship at Valhalla, where he would miss the cut. And at Valhalla, he again struggled with his back, and Woods announced after that event that he would take a break from the game, and he also parted company with his swing coach of 4 years, Sean Foley. But in November, Woods sort of emerged from hibernation, and he revealed that he started working with 37-year-old Chris Como, who is an expert in biomechanics and a highly regarded, if not widely known, golf coach, much like Fred Altbater. Very good, but not well known. Returning to action a fortnight ago at the Hero World Challenge, we were able to witness Tiger's latest incarnation, if you like. But, you know, visibly, he looked different. He looked noticeably lighter in terms of his weight, with a great deal of his muscle mass having dissipated. Tiger said he lost 5 pounds, and it was more than that. I don't believe a word that he says, but he lost more than 5 pounds. He was a much leaner-looking guy at Isleworth there. And much of the work between Como and Woods has looked back on Tiger's swing as a junior and an amateur before he changed his swing with Butch Harmon after winning the Masters in 97. And they're trying to carry some of the principles of that swing to the one that he hopes to have in action for next year. And, you know, I have to say, despite finishing joint last in the 18-man challenge, I thought Tiger's swing looked pretty good for the most part, given the layoff. You know, it seemed to be more natural to me, and he appeared to be in more control of his long game, particularly off the tee, which has been his real foe in the past year. So he's really struggled with his driver, but he looked better with that club at Isleworth there. So, you know, in that respect, it wasn't a bad performance after a four-month layoff. But what was shocking, however, was how astonishingly bad his chipping was. You know, it was incredible to watch him, you know, duff chip after chip. It was almost as if he was doing it deliberately. It was incredible to see. And, you know, yes, the Bermuda grass is grainy and it isn't easy to play from, but his chipping was just remarkably bad. You know, technically, just, you know, it was amateurish, like a 20 handicapper trying to chip. It was awful. And, you know, that would ultimately really be his downfall in Florida there. You can't score having, you know, flubbed 18 chips. But there were positives. Most notably, that he completed four rounds pain-free. But the question is, can he get back to the top and challenge Rory McIlroy? And with so many good players, young players establishing themselves at the moment, the environment has never been harder for Woods to get back and dominate, particularly as he approaches his 40th year of life. He turns 39 at the end of the month. But, you know, we say it all the time, he is Tiger Woods, quite possibly the most gifted player in the history of the game. And that talent just doesn't disappear. It's always there. So if he stays fit, and if his drive and determination remain strong, I do expect Tiger to come back and win next season, perhaps multiple times. But whether he can get back to number one and win majors again remains to be seen. But he will certainly be a threat. Of that I have no doubt. But, you know, it's a huge year come up for Woods. And it will certainly be very interesting, Carlos, where we rank Tiger on this very list 12 months from now.
I look forward to that. You know, he's still the game's most transcendent figure, and he's come back now in December. He definitely looked healthy, but like you mentioned, he looked like a 20 handicapper on the greens. I mean, I was looking at him, and I was saying, hey, I can hit it 1 foot farther than him. It's just like me. Oh, my God. I was so amazed I can do that. But, you know, his soap opera, one good thing this year was that it was minor compared with what has happened in the past with him, in that it was entirely centered on his golf. He was playing today on the opening of his first design golf course in Cabo San Lucas. You know, he's also entering now the design market. And the jury is still out on how his pairing with his new swing coach, Chris Como, is going to work out. And I'm going to call him a coach, not a consultant, because I cannot put my head around Tiger asking, hey, Chris, can I consult you something about my swing? I mean, golf definitely needs him, but he better do something soon. Like you said, Kieran, Rory is about to open the door and replace him as the most important guy in golf. And Fred, let's not forget, there's a guy also called Jordan Spieth, who's a blimp right now on the radar, but it's getting bigger and bigger and bigger as the tournaments go by.
You know, guys, I hate to say this. You know, I love watching Tiger play. I feel so fortunate to have been able to watch his whole career, but we may be seeing the end of one of the best careers the golf world has ever seen. Jack Nicklaus's record of 18 major titles appears to be safe for the moment. Other athletes have returned to the arena better after back and neck surgery, namely Davis Love and Peyton Manning most recently. The real problem with Tiger, though, is his legs. Numerous knee and Achilles injuries, surgeries have left him with some creaky old legs, and we know how important legs are to walking and hitting a golf ball prodigious distances. 2014 was yet another wasted year for Woods, who has not won a major since 2008. 2008! Who would have thought that possible? 6 years of majors, 24 tournaments, and no major titles. From age 33 to 39, that should have been the prime of his career. He should have won a minimum of two and probably four in that time, if not more. Five regular tournament wins in 2013, as Kieran says, you know, demonstrates that when healthy, Tiger can still beat just about everybody. But I'm beginning to wonder just how many more wins Tiger has left in his tank. But how strong is golf? What does it say about golf overall that in 2014, Tiger is relegated to number five on our list? That says a lot to me right there. Let's move on to number four, the Ted Bishop situation. You know, what a huge story that became, and what an unfortunate mishap for one of the most dominant and recognizable PGA of America presence of all time, Ted Bishop. The PGA of America, along with the USGA, are keepers of golf in the United States, and they take their role very seriously indeed, maybe even too much so. They are typical bureaucratic institutions with rigid rules and procedures,
you know, one does not dare to be seen in public without one's sports coat or tan pants. Ted Bishop assumed the presidency of the 27,000-member PGA of America in 2012 after being a PGA professional for many years and had served in various capacities inside the organization. The PGA of America, with Ted Bishop as its president, presided over several major issues in golf over the past 2 years. There was a lot of heat brought to bear after the debacle at the Ryder Cup and the Tom Watson mutiny. But prior to that, with Bishop leading the charge for the PGA and the media, questioned the RNA and the USGA in the banning of the anchored putter in 2016. They were unsuccessful in their efforts, but raised several worthwhile arguments to the belly putter discussion. The PGA assumed a major role in the drive, chip, and putt competition sponsored by Augusta National and conducts all the qualifying tournaments for boys and girls around the country. It was Ted Bishop, along with PGA of America CEO Pete Bavaca, on the stage with LPGA Tour Commissioner Michael Wan and the president of KPMG when the new KPMG Women's PGA Tournament was announced to the public with the largest purse in women's golf. Ted Bishop is 60 years old and has a much different view of the world than the normal Twitter or Facebook user. He has two daughters that are actively involved in the golf industry and is a grandfather that understands the differences between boys and girls. When he was growing up, he heard things like, "Be a man, don't act like a little girl, and you're throwing like a girl." I'm sure he even admonishes his grandchildren with the same style of tough love when trying to teach them a certain skill or sport. It's not meant to be sexist or demeaning. It's simply what he learned from his parents. Nonetheless, his comments that were made to Ian Poulter in defense of Nick Faldo via Facebook and Twitter enlisted a hailstorm of negative press, and the PGA of America deemed it best that Bishop be relieved of his position just a mere 30 days before his term would have ended. Social media makes the world a much different place than small-town Indiana, where Bishop hails from. The gender gap does exist and is most notable in everyday conversations on social media outlets. The comments Bishop made on Twitter and Facebook aimed at Ian Poulter were wrong, especially by today's politically correct standards. They were never meant to be sexist or blown completely out of proportion by the oversensitive media. Everyone can learn a valuable lesson from Mr. Bishop pertaining to the correct usage of social media, Kieran. Think twice, hit send once, or better yet, not at all.
Well, I think Ted Bishop will never make that mistake again, that's for sure. But, you know, Fred, I agree with just everything you said there regarding Ted Bishop. For me, you know, there was no sexist intent in what he said. It's a fairly common terminology, as you say there. It's commonly used, in particularly sports, in regard to, you know, particularly kids as well. And to me, what offended me most about it, I'm not a politically correct person as such. I'm irritated by people who seem to be offended by everything. It annoys me. I can't stand it. But anyway, I'm offended by people who are offended, but that's another thing entirely. But what offended me about Ted Bishop was actually he felt it was appropriate for a man in his position to go and get in a sort of childish argument with Ian Poulter. I thought that was quite ridiculous. But as for the comments themselves, I think it was all very overblown. And I felt it was an overreaction from the PGA of America, to be honest with you, and the way they handled it. And perhaps there's something else behind the scenes that influenced that as well, because it seemed very over the top to expunge him from history, as it were, what they kind of did with him. So I'm not sure what went on in the background of the PGA of America, but as for those comments, it was a stupid thing to do, and you should never have said it, but for me there was no sexist intent from Ted Bishop. It was just the wrong thing to do. And in the end, he was with Nick Faldo at the time, of course, at the Greenbrier, and I think Bishop suffered from a kind of a hero worship thing. He did it with Tom Watson, fawning around Tom Watson for 2 years. He's done it with Nick Faldo. And really, let's be honest here, defending Nick Faldo is never going to end that well. So, you know, Bishop made many mistakes, but I think for him, it was, I just think he was a bit harshly treated overall in terms of the situation. But certainly, as a PGA of America president, he certainly fought his corner and he did a lot of good things. But Carlos, you know, he will forever be remembered, of course, for this faux pas, this fallout from the Twitter exchange.
You know, Ted Bishop went against the protocol when he named Tom Watson to be Ryder Cup captain for a second time, making him the oldest captain ever. And after the bid loss, he was on the ropes defending himself from blows that were coming from all angles. So when he took to social media that fateful Thursday evening to attack Ian Poulter for his criticism of former Ryder Cup captain Nick Faldo, calling Poulter a little girl, a Pandora box was opened. You know, those posts were deleted, but just like TV, live TV or radio, they were made and people got it. Like you mentioned, like you have mentioned, Kieran, for a person of his position, it shouldn't have been done. But all I have to say left is we should just loosen up a little bit and stop bickering like little girls and move on. He was a great guy. And,
well,
let's just forget about this. Let's just forget about it.
Touché.
Yeah. So that wraps up number four. And we're going now for number three. And that has to be about Rory McIlroy's ups and downs. All of which reminds us that the number one soap opera of the year could have been, perhaps should have been, Rory McIlroy's decision to break off his engagement from Caroline Wozniacki a few days after the wedding invitations went out. Ouch. But, you know, on the day he made the announcement, McIlroy showed up at the scheduled pre-tournament news conference in London and did not play the "I don't want to talk about my personal life" card. He answered questions, he took the blame for the breakup, and then he went out and won the golf tournament 5 days later. Coincidence or not, maybe not, that was the week, the beginning of one of the most torrid streaks golf has seen since Tiger Woods stopped being Tiger Woods. Let's recap it. You know, he carded a 6-under final round to beat Thomas Bjorn, who started 7 strokes clear of McIlroy on the final day in May to win the BMW PGA Championship trophy at Wentworth. He then saw off Ricky Fowler and Sergio Garcia to capture the third major of his career and lifted the claret jug after winning the Open Championship at Royal Liverpool in July. He returned to the top of the world rankings in August after winning the WGC Bridgestone Invitational at Firestone in Ohio by 2 strokes from Sergio Garcia. Edged out Phil Mickelson and Ricky Fowler to win the PGA Championship in near darkness at Valhalla and capture back-to-back majors. He was part of that European team that successfully defended the Ryder Cup at Gleneagles in Scotland. November saw him win the race to Dubai for the second time in 3 years without playing because Sergio Garcia, Marcel Siem, and Jamie Donaldson failed to win. He was awarded the Vardon Trophy by the PGA of America for the lowest aggregate score on the U.S. Tour during the season. What an up season. Of course, he had some downs, like when his choice of suit became a talking point in the media on a trip to Old Trafford to display the claret jug. We all remember that serious fashion faux pas. But on a more serious note is the lawsuit that he has against Horizon, his former management agency, that has intensified, and he had to take our time away from the sport to prepare for the court case that is expected to involve fellow golfer and friend Graham McDowell next February. He has said that his number one goal for 2015 is to complete the career Grand Slam by winning the Masters, which will end 3 weeks before he turns 26. His absence is not only a serious blow for the tournaments he missed and will miss, but puts at risk those lofty goals of his. Fred, in short, the McIlroy soap opera was canceled by his brilliant golf, and no doubt we will hear more from him, and hopefully we can see history when he completes the career Grand Slam there in the Masters.
Yeah, I can't wait. You know, we're still 3-4 months away from that, and I'm ready to go for it right now. But, you know, Rory was having a pretty good season, you know, in the early part of the year. He had 6 top 10s in his first 9 starts in the United States. And as you mentioned, he went over there to England, won the BMW PGA Championship on the European Tour at the end of May, you know, right after the announced breakup with Caroline. He came back to the U.S., was T15 at the Memorial and T23 at Pinehurst for the U.S. Open, but then he shifted into that higher gear and won the Open, won the WGC Bridgestone and the PGA Championship in you know, consecutive fashion. He finished out with 3 top 10s
in the FedEx Cup and nailed down the race to Dubai without hitting a shot in the European Tour's final series until recording a runner-up finish to Stenson at the DP World Championship in Dubai. Coming off his subpar year in 2013, it was a dominating year and one that has golf fans anxious to see if he can complete that career Grand Slam in April and just how many majors he can add to his mantle in the coming years. And, Kieran, you know, I think that Monty maybe having that early onset of dementia, you know, claiming that Rory is better than Tiger was at this time, I'm not too sure Monty's all there on that one.
To be fair, Fred, Monty has never been all there, to be honest with you, so it's no real surprise to hear comments like that from him. But, you know, what impressed me most about Rory McIlroy this year, and we saw it in the past where when he played to his best, he destroyed fields. We saw it at Congressional and at Kiawah Island. He won by huge margins. So when he was at his best, he was the best. But his B game often wasn't very good. But this season, this year, his B game has been as good as anybody else's. And for me, his PGA Championship victory at Valhalla was an example of that. On that Sunday, he was well down. He was down on the start of the back nine. He was behind. He wasn't playing his best, but he ground out the result. And for me, that was Tiger-esque. You know, for me, it was a case of not just going out there and struggling fields by eight shots. It was a case of he ground out a result there, and that is a true sign of a champion. He can win when not at his best. And that is an ominous sign for the rest of the players in the game of golf in the coming years. As Rory has a talent where how many majors can we win? Who can say? Really, anything can happen in life. But you know, right now, you've got to say he can win as many as almost he wants to win. When he plays to his best, I don't think anyone else can touch him. And even now, with his B game, he's still up there and can still grind out wins. And that is such a huge asset. And for me, he will win the Grand Slam one day. It's unthinkable he will not win the Masters in my mind. It might not be next year, but certainly it's an exciting plot going into the year's first major, Augusta National. But as Carlos mentioned there about the Horizon lawsuit, I remain to be convinced that this will actually go to court. I think it might end up being settled because the impact it will have on his golf could be quite detrimental. And in the end, the money that Horizon are after isn't that much in the reality for Rory McIlroy, given the massive money he's gained over the years. So that may still be settled out of court, I believe, in the new year. But we'll wait and see how that goes down. But right now, from a golfing perspective, Rory McIlroy, you know, he's playing the best golf we have seen since Tiger 10 years ago. And that's something that we as golf fans should really enjoy and appreciate, and we certainly have done. And there's more to come from Rory in the coming years. And 2015 should be a real... promises to be a really intriguing year for him. Look at St Andrews for the Open Championship. He's got a fantastic record at the Old Course. You know, for me, he's almost nailed on to be favourite to win the Open Championship in July. So 2015 could be an equally as good year as 2014. But someone, gentlemen, that was number three in our list. And now they get to number two. And you mentioned there, Fred, Colin Montgomery. And Colin Montgomery won two majors this year. Good for him. But unfortunately, he's not on our list anywhere. Sorry, Monty. You don't have to deal with that. So, Monty was number 17 behind my par in the road hole. I was number 16. He was number 17.
He was way down the list.
He was number 17. Number two is a wonderful young player who is yet to win a major championship, but she is destined to win a whole host of them and completed one of the most remarkable seasons from a great rookie season on the LPGA Tour from one of the truly great talents that anyone's really ever seen, particularly in the ladies' game. As I said so many times tonight, 2014 was a great year for the LPGA. You know, so many dramatic moments, exciting finishes, great winners, and I must say quickly, the best shot of the year was Mo Martin's shot into the 18th at the Birkdale for the Women's Open. That was tremendous. But anyway, a strong season for the LPGA Tour, a tour that had been struggling just a few years ago. But one name that continually stands out for me is Lydia Ko. She is a phenomenon, an unbelievable talent, and her rookie year as a professional was just as startling as her achievements as an amateur. And, you know, it's worth reflecting on what she did before turning pro. Winning the Canadian Open as a 15-year-old amateur in 2012, becoming the youngest ever winner of an LPGA event. And she returned that last year and successfully defended that title as an amateur. You know, I've said this before in the show, and people might kind of roll their eyes and say, what is he talking about? You know, but I do truly regard that as one of the finest achievements in the history of the game. To win those back-to-back at the Canadian Open at 15 and 16 as an amateur, for me, that's just in the top 10, best achievements ever. That's up there with Frances Wee Mitt in the 1913 U.S. Open for me at Brookline. But anyway, moving on.
At different courses, too.
Absolutely, Fred. For me, it's just that's a remarkable achievement, very underrated for last year. But for me, going into this year, of course, even better achievements. And she finished second last year at the Evian Championship. Then she announced she was turning pro, and she was granted access to the LPGA from the Tour Commissioner Michael Wan, despite being under 18, of course. And she claimed her first title as a professional this April at the Swinging Skirts, a terrible name for an event, but a fantastic win for her, beating Stacey Lewis to the win. And she turned 17 that week. Incredible. And in July, Fred, she'd win in your backyard in Ohio at the Marathon Classic, which catapulted her onto a strong finishes in the year's final two majors. And she would end this remarkable rookie season in perfect fashion in Florida a couple of weeks ago as she overcame Carlota Saganda and Julieta Granada to win the CME Group Tour Championship. Complete absolutely remarkable rookie season and finishing the year third on the Rolex ranking as well as the CME Globe point standings in the LPGA Tour. Behind Lewis and MB Park, the South Korean-born New Zealander has already been named one of Time Magazine's 100 most influential people. And Fred, I think you're on a list, that list too somewhere, but I wasn't too sure if I could see you. But anyway.
Just below the 100. I was just off the list, yeah.
102. I think you were 102. Carlos was 101. You were 102. But for Lydia Cole, you have to expect that her reputation will only grow in 2015, and it's certainly going to be fun to watch. And I must end with a quote here from Annika Sörenstam on Lydia Cole, which I think is a really interesting one. She says here on Lydia, Annika said, Cole is exceptionally talented, mature beyond her years, and well-liked by golf fans and competitors alike. She is responsible for sparking increased interest in her sport, not just in her native South Africa and adopted homeland in New Zealand, but also among juniors across the globe. Lydia Cole is someone who's going to inspire young girls to play the game of golf. And, Carlos, she's a remarkable talent, and there's only going to be more to come from her next year.
11 days after Tiger Woods won the Masters in his first full season on the PGA Tour, an 8-pound, 8-ounce girl was born in Seoul, South Korea. 17 years later, Lydia Ko provided further evidence that the game's next transcendent player, the crown prince to Woods' king, may be in fact a princess. She has already won 5 LPGA titles under her belt since she burst into the scene in 2012 and became the youngest person to win an LPGA title at the age of 15. And like you mentioned, she was named one of the top 100 most influential people by Time Magazine, but she still says she has still ways to go. She will now be balancing golf with studies, which might be a good thing because it might level the field now against her opponents. And for 2 years, the LPGA has been trumpeting the rivalry between Stacey Lewis and Inbay Park as the best in the game. But, I don't know, even though Lexi Thompson is out there, I see that there is a budding rivalry that could blossom into a bountiful bouquet for the LPGA, and that's Lydia Ko versus Charlie Hall, you know, that 18-year-old wunderkind from the Ladies European Tour and who starred for Europe in last year's Solheim Cup and who happened to just won the Ladies European Tour's Order of Merit. She will be in the LPGA also making the restricted list qualifier. So, Fred, I think that will be a great budding rivalry to come. And for Lydia, it's a cold Christmas.
Yeah, you know, what can you add to Lydia Ko's most excellent adventure on the LPGA Tour in 2014? Rookie of the Year, 3 wins. One of those, the $500,000 first-place check for the CME Globe Tour Championship. The $1 million bonus for winning the race to the CME Globe. And all the while playing with the confidence and the calm demeanor of a veteran. Did I mention she's only 17? Is she going to get burned out by the time she's 21? You know, what is there left for this girl? Oh yeah, she hasn't won a major yet, but she already has one runner-up and one third-place finish in just a couple majors that she's played so far. Well, it won't be too long till she'll probably see one of those big trophies on her mantle. I really can see her going on a run like Yanni Singh did a few years ago and winning several majors over the next 4 or 5 years. She does have some pretty good competition, as you mentioned.
You know, we've got Lexi Thompson, Michelle Wee, Enby, Stacy, and Charlie Hall just added her name into the ring. So it's not going to be easy, but, you know, she's beaten these girls before, so I think she'll be able to do it again. She has the perfect game for major titles, and they will probably come as soon as next year. Guys, that is 14 of our top 15 stories. Carlos, if you got a drum roll there, we've got one big story left. Yeah. Guess what? The Ryder Cup. There was a Ryder Cup in 2014, if you've forgotten yet. We just stopped talking about it last week, I think. you know, I have kept my spots here on the show short tonight as we progressed up through the top 15, but I am not going to be able to keep it short for this Ryder Cup. And I know you're both itching to pounce on anything that I fail to mention. So here it goes. The U.S. Ryder Cup team seemed doomed from the start, choosing 58-year-old Tom Watson to lead this bunch of young, spoiled professional golfers. You know, it could be worse than herding hogs. It's just like a nearly impossible task. Throw in a 30 to 50-year gender gap, injuries to Jason Duffner as well as Tiger Woods, and in AWOL Dustin Johnson, you have the recipe for a disaster. Phil took exception to being sat out. Watson kept him out a whole day. Oh, the embarrassment. Why did you keep Reed and Spieth out of a session when they were the only bright spot? Tiger couldn't play and Phil was playing badly. He even brought Keegan Bradley down to his level. Any combination that Captain Tom put out there seemed to fail miserably. In a fit of frustration, Watson lost in a team meeting and said some demeaning things and just made some fellas feel bad to these poor, unfortunate, rich beyond reason, spoiled professionals, and they simply refused to perform for him. On top of all that, they crucified him in the media in front of his face. Bad show all around. Getting your ass kicked all over Scotland and acting like a bunch of spoiled brats doing it. Well, you know, now that I think of it, maybe that is a fairly typical American Ryder Cup performance. Reed, Spieth, and Fowler were the only bright spots on the U.S. Ryder Cup team, and they're young enough to be the future for the Americans. Hopefully, they weren't scarred too badly by this year's Ryder Cup. Handed to Paul McGinley and the Europeans. They were wonderful. Just like 2 years ago in Chicago, the team all pulled together. They actually seemed to enjoy one another's company, and they adored their captain. Hey, boys, let's drop over to jolly old Glen Eagles, have a bit of a laugh, drink a pint or two, and play a little golf. Maybe even pop a cork or two. What fun. The Ryder Cup has become one of the biggest sporting events in the world, so it has to be accorded a huge amount of time, concentration, and media coverage. The 2014 Ryder Cup aftermath is this. The U.S. has lost 7 of the last 9 Ryder Cups. We now have a task force dominated by Tiger Woods and Phil Mickelson to pick a U.S. captain. The PGA of America is running around like a chicken with its head cut off, wondering why the sky is falling. And all the while, the Euros are having a good laugh, drinking a pint or two, and loving every minute of it. Kieran.
Yeah, absolutely, Fred. And, you know, really, it's a Ryder Cup in many ways that the aftermath was more compelling than the actual Ryder Cup itself, which in many ways was quite an underwhelming Ryder Cup. It was over really on Saturday afternoon. There was no way the Americans were coming back from that deficit. And in many ways, as you say, Fred, the American team was doomed on the way in. You know, we kind of feared, firstly, obviously, they lost form players like Horschel and Kirk. Guys weren't playing well. Mickelson, Simpson, they were in poor form. No Tiger, no Dustin. It was a very weak American team in reality. And captained by Tom Watson, when he was announced as captain 2 years ago, we all kind of felt that, yeah, we kind of see what they're trying to do, but is the, as you say, 30-year age gap, would that prove to be telling in terms of his approach and the way he handles things? And the answer to that was universally yes. And Watson, in many ways, is a very old-school character. In many ways, not a warm man, let's put it that way. while Paul McGinley was warm to his players, liked his players, had a good relationship with him, Tom Watson was more of the headmaster at the school. And that approach these days just does not work. And it was unfortunate in many ways as well, because it sort of took away from the Ryder Cup as a spectacle, as a contest. But as you say, for the Americans, the bright spots were the young players, Spieth, Fowler, Reed. They were outstanding and could be big players for them in the future. But certainly the aftermath of the Ryder Cup is what's really compelling and what's going to be the future for the American team in particular. This may be the last straw for them. Look at how they do it. It's not so much about how they pick a captain, how they pick a team. It's more about how the Americans approach it as individuals as well as collectively. As you say, Fred, the Europeans are always more relaxed. They always seem to get on better with each other. Maybe it's just the PGA Tour thing. Maybe the PGA Tour guys are so competitive against each other head-to-head that there is a real kind of division in the ranks there. It's hard to bring, you know, guys who are so separate during the year together once every year and try and create an artificial team environment. The Europeans do that far more effectively, while the Americans didn't. Of course, we should compliment the European team. They've played tremendously well for the most part. As I say, going in, if the Europeans' best players, McIlroy, Rose, Stenson, Garcia, if they played well, the Europeans were going to win, and they all played well. And that was ultimately the case, and why they won the Ryder Cup at Glen Eagles. But certainly, look ahead to Hazeltine in 2 years' time. You know, the fallout continues with the task force and all that kind of stuff, and who's going to be the next captain? Is it going to be Freddie Couples? Is it going to be Paul Azinger? Or maybe someone else? You know, who knows? But ultimately, the U.S. team, U.S. players, and you know, overall, the leadership as well in the PGA of America, they have to look at the thing differently. Look at how the European Tour does it. Look at how the European team approach it and copy what they do, because quite clearly, the way the European team do it, that's working. So, Carlos, that's what the American team have got to do. Emulate the Europeans.
I have to agree with you. And I don't know what else can I add to what... I knew I had the short end of the straw being the last one to talk about the Ryder Cup this tonight. But, you know, but no, I have to agree with you, Kieran. I have always said it's the approach. You can change the baby, but if you don't change the diaper, you know, it's never going to change. So they have to change the approach. I believe the Europeans got it. They just have to go look at it and imitate it, duplicate it, and hey, until they don't do that, we won't go anywhere. That wraps up our top 15 stories for the 2014 year. We hope you have enjoyed it. We still have a little bit more to go, but hey, those were great stories. Hope you like it. We're going to take a very short break. I know we've been here for an hour and a half. We still have a couple more minutes to go, so don't go away. We'll be right back with some more.
Thank you for listening. We'll be right back. In the meantime, don't forget to visit www.edraft.com for analysis, breaking news, and more. Also, remember to follow us on Twitter at edraftsports and on Facebook at facebook.com/edraftsports. Now, back to the show.
And we're back, and now it's time for some final thoughts from us. And we're going to start with Fred. Fred, take it away.
Hey, guys. As we wrap up this last show of 2014, we want to take just a few minutes to thank our listeners. We hope that you can hear how much we enjoy bringing you our take on the golf news and highlights each week. This is our 85th show. And in January, we will embark on our third year of Back Nine Report. We want to thank all of the wonderful guests that have been kind enough to talk with us to bring our audience the most current and interesting interviews and information. Special thanks to Matt Janella from the Golf Channel, Craig Kahn, and Michael Wan from the LPGA Tour, World Golf Foundation CEO Steve Mona, author Jim Dotson, Global Golf Post founder and president Jim Nugent, First Tee President Joe Lewis Barrow, and the countless other guests that make our show so unique. Carlos and I both appreciate the efforts of our friend from Scotland, Kieran Clark, to bring his insight from across the Atlantic and offers another perspective on the golf world.
We want to thank eDraft.com for sponsoring our show and providing us the forum and time on air to present the show each week. And we want to offer a special thanks to Ryan Belangi from Golf News Net that adds our show to his GNN radio each week, 24/7 streaming on TuneIn. We also want to recognize United Golf Network. Beginning in January, they will be a new sponsor for the show and will help us with the latest information on club technology and golf products. And I also want to thank my co-host Carlos for his expert work in setting up the show every week. He handles all the technical stuff for the show and keeps us on track. We will be back on Tuesday, January 6th with an all-new show. And until then, Carlos, Kieran, and I want to wish all of you a Merry Christmas and a very happy and prosperous New Year. And Carlos, I turn it back to you with that.
Well, I think those were great words. And now let's turn it over to Kieran so he can have his final thoughts for this year.
I'm not sure I can follow what Fred said there. That was magnificent.
That's why I passed it on to you.
It was remarkable.
I passed it on to
Fred's
you.
Fred's running for Congress, but after that. But, yeah, you know, as I always say, I'm always grateful to be on the show. To be asked on to talk golf is a great thrill for me. And I enjoy the time I spend with you guys talking about it. I appreciate the friendship we have and the mutual interest we have in the game of golf. And, you know, it's a great thrill for me to be able to first of all, write about the game of golf and eDraft and also to talk about it. You know, it's a great passion of mine. And to have that platform is a huge thrill. And, you know, really, it wouldn't be anything without the listeners and also the people who read the articles online. And I want to thank all of them, people who retweet the show and try and promote us and give us so much support. And we have a sort of a small audience, but a very dedicated one. And people do enjoy the show. They don't always talk about it or let you know, but they've told me before, people do enjoy the show. They listen to it on their way to work and stuff like this in the morning. People do appreciate what we do on the show and what you guys do every single week. I only pop in every so often, but you guys are here every Tuesday night, and you both do an incredible job, particularly Carlos with setting up the show. And Fred, you know, you offer your insight and your knowledge in the game of golf, your experience, and it really makes for a really good show. Much like yourself, Fred, I'd like to wish everybody a wonderful festive period, a Merry Christmas to everyone. Hope you have a really safe and a healthy holiday season, and you have a great and wonderful start 2015. You know, I've had my difficulties this year. I appreciate Carlos filling in for me on eDraft during a couple of months there back in the fall. But I'm back on form. I look forward to 2015. A great year for golf is going to be. So many great stories, so many plot lines going in. And we look forward to bringing it to you on eDraft.com in terms of the articles and also on the Back Nine Report, bringing the latest news and insights and all the great stories to you on the Back Nine Report every Tuesday night. So please stick with us next year. It's going to get bigger and better, and hope you enjoy it.
There are a lot of great things we have in store for you, and I just want to subscribe to all the things. Thanks, Fred, for giving me the opportunity to be your co-host here every Tuesday. It's something that I look forward to, and when I'm not in the show, I'm like with a coffee withdrawal. I need to do something. I even start at the same 8 p.m. Eastern time. I start my show even though if I'm not here, so that's how I feel about it. So, and Kieran, always great to have you here. Great that you're back and you're inside, like you said, the friendship we have done, even though you don't know, or you might know already, Kieran is in Scotland, Fred is in Toledo, Ohio, the center of the universe of golf, like he calls it.